welcome back after the coffee break, and let's continue with the discussion here. I should mention that the team here, Gunnar, Subrenda, and colleagues, also have an article in Biståndsdebatten. So if you want to know even more after this discussion, you can read that after the seminar. Well, of course, you will read the report, but still, you can read the short article there too. I should perhaps also say that this happens to be a good, particularly good day to launch the report. Come to think of it, for two reasons, because today is this International Forestry Day, so that's of course very appropriate, and today was another UN Day, it was the Global Happiness Day, so we have many reasons to celebrate here. Now, for a start, I would like to invite the panel participants to come up here. So, Alison Pollard and Ivar Egana and Anders Granlund as well. If you come up here at the same time, that would be good. And it's a particular pleasure to have all of you here, and Alison in particular. We have been working together on evaluations many times in the past, and Alison has also been on the reference group for this study and is DFID's evaluation advisor in the field of climate change interventions. She has been in different parts of the UK government before coming to DFID. You were with the Ministry of Justice, and before that in the civil society organizations and the LSE. So you're very welcome.
Thank you.
And we look forward to hearing what you have to say about the report and about DFID's work in this field. And it's particularly interesting, as I know that you are right now planning future work in terms of both monitoring and evaluation and making sure that you learn from this process. So you're welcome, Alison.
Thank you. Okay, first of all, thank you very much. Sorry for inviting me here. It's great to be part of this seminar, and it was also a very good experience to be part of the advisory group. I think the findings are very useful and timely. So we all know that climate change poses one of the most significant long-term challenges that we face as the world, and that the poorest and the most vulnerable communities are disproportionately most affected, whether it be they're living in vulnerable areas, low-lying areas, livelihoods dependent on natural environment, having less savings to be resilient to the shocks and stresses of climate change. And it's very much an emerging area, as the research team have pointed out. We have some evaluation evidence, learning and knowledge, but in comparison to areas such as health and education, the evidence base is more limited. So the UK is a big supporter of programmes that aim to both tackle climate change and reduce poverty. And in our latest overseas development aid strategy, we've committed £5.8 billion to programmes that aim to address these causes. So we're looking at about a 50-50 split, 50% for adaptation and resilience programmes and 50% for mitigation, low-carbon growth. And within that, we've also committed £1.2 billion for forestry programmes. So big commitments and interests in the field. And I also believe that good development is sustainable development, and that means that it's climate smart, whether that's improving resilience, infrastructure, making sure that agricultural methods are appropriate for changes in the climate, and that schools and hospitals are able to withstand and thrive in the context of climate change. So I've talked about the evaluation being very timely, and it was a great experience being a member of the advisory group. So I strongly believe that we all need to work together, and it was really a positive experience to work with colleagues at CEDA, and great to hear my colleague from NORAD talking about the evaluation. At the end of the report, there's reference to looking at alternative methods that we'll need as we move forward to evaluate climate change programs. And I perhaps feel a bit more positive than some of the researchers suggest, and I'm more aligned with Ivor's view from NORAD about there is more knowledge and evidence out there than have been identified in this very useful but also fairly robust framework for identifying impact evaluations. So whilst the UK is supporting impact evaluations of some of our climate change investments, I don't think that it's always desirable to use a traditional impact evaluation approach. I think quite often we need to be asking ourselves questions about how, why, for whom, and under what circumstances and in different contexts are programs delivering results, and if not, why not? So that's the desirability. And the second point is it's often just not possible to use traditional impact evaluations, particularly if we look at the resilience building and adaptation themes and areas of investments. It's often just not a reality that we can consider to create a counterfactual group. Meanwhile, we're operating in very complex situations where it's difficult to isolate a specific intervention and the effects of a specific intervention. So I think as evaluators, it's an exciting opportunity for us to kind of challenge ourselves to look at the evaluation toolbox and look at other methods that we might use to understand the effects that different programs have for different types of people, and to answer the how and why questions. So I like the idea of leaving it on a positive note and saying that DFID is looking at a number of different evaluation approaches that we're investing in. So again, the evidence base is growing, and we don't think that knowledge and evidence is just a result of impact evaluation. It's much broader. So we're using theory-based evaluations, realist approaches, looking at more participatory methods, and as Kim talked about, looking at different approaches to monitoring, evaluating, and learning.
Thank you very much, Alison, and thanks for that positive note. Okay, good. Anders, it's a pleasure to have you here too. You haven't traveled as far, but you're equally welcome. Will be nice to hear what you have to say from CEDA's point of view. And Anders Granlund has also been a member of the reference group for the study, and is the lead policy specialist for environment and climate in CEDA. And apart from having been to CEDA, I think you have a background from the research corporation as well. Were you with SAREC in the past? Yes. Nice, so you are actually in person bridging the no-do gap.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Kim, and thank you for being here and trying to tell a little bit what CEDA feel about this and what we are doing today in a very short way. I think this study, I'm supposed to say this little study, because I think you have... It's a very broad picture you try to do, but since it's just these two areas, there are a little bit more in the reality we are working with today. And it's interesting that we are now in 2016 and we see this report, and we see also the gaps that we probably need to address in some way. And that's why I start with your recommendations. I think they are, in fact, doable, some of them, because this is something we strive. We strive very hard within CEDA to understand the role, and especially now the role of a donor organization, because I think 2016 we can also see a little bit of difference on how we are working. We used to be doing projects and programs from the very start to the very end, not that long ago, but now we can see that we have limited resources. And it has not so much to do with the money, with the amount of resources in that way. It has much more to do with human resources and how many we are working with this. So there is a trend also that perhaps it's not visible in the study that a lot of what we are working with today, there are very few people working with that also within a donor organization. So with that, I think we are also looking a little bit in how to change the role for a donor organization. It's easy to say that we have to be catalytic, but we probably have to be more working with others. We have to look at some of the other players around here. And we have experience, of course, working with the recipient countries and the people who are down there. And they come from various sectors, like the academia, like the NGOs. But I see now, especially in the climate environment, a big change with the private sector. And that is also, I like your presentation, Mark. But if you look at that, it's that spaghetti piece of things. You can see that most of the resources, they are the private, they are the investments going on. But it's interesting to see the shift in the interest of the private sector or the market to actually do changes. And it has nothing to do with that we donors say that they should do it, or they have perhaps, well, in some way they have a moral obligatory, but I think it's also that now we can see a new emerging market in this. And that is very interesting because that means things might change. But how will they do the best things? I think they need a little bit from the academia, but also from the donors. Because as my colleague Ivar and Alicia has said, we have a lot of experience working with evaluations, working with what we have produced the last 40 years in donor business. And I think that should be used. We should be more a broker. We should be more working with that. And if you look into the study here, we can see that some of these ideas are also reflected, that we need to focus more on what others are doing. Unfortunately, in the terms of reference for this, we did not ask the survey group, the researchers, to look into the private sector as an interesting target. But you can read between the lines in the report that a lot of things happen in China and very little happens in Africa, for example, or South America. But why does it happen in China? It's also because the industry in China can see a new morning coming up with the alternative energy. I was thinking of this little company called Suslon. It's a German-Chinese experiment that is so large that SIDA could not pay for the catering staff in the vicinities. But what we see is that they find a market into look into alternative energies for households, using sun, using small grid powers, and that is probably more change in that than we can see in lots of other donor-driven initiatives. So we need more to come up with communication skills into that. And that is a little bit my conclusion to this, that communications is so vital today to actually be there working as a donor, trying to do something in this huge field. And what we can start with, of course, is to have perhaps a little better communication among donors, but also with other actors, especially all the interesting things that happens today with the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller. We used to say that they were just interested in bits and pieces, but if we look at it, they are really changers of what we are doing. So with that, I think this little report have started to discuss vital information about how we could be more efficient. Now we have these two sectors. I really miss that you didn't bring in the coastal management area, because there we have also very much learning in how to work in an integrated way. Because for CEDA today, it's a lot of working with integrations. We would like to see a combination of human rights issues, gender issues, together with climate and environment, as well as we would like to see more focused, specific projects or programs where we can probably be more a partner to big programs in climate and environment. And importantly, probably Anders Wahlberg will mention that, but all the multinational initiatives we are involved in, they are a crucial part into this also, because there we can gain knowledge into how we should continue with what we are doing. So, in a short, I think the report has its flavor to be an interesting one, but we need to follow it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anders.
Thank you.
Ivar, would you like to respond a little bit to what you have heard Alison and Anders say about the approaches in CEDA and DFID? Seems to resonate fairly well with your thinking, if I recall your final slides about your how you take things forward and how you agree with and where you think that there are other approaches more complex than needed in terms of a report. But I leave that for you to say.
Thank you very much. You're quite right. I think it resonates well. And we are very happy to see that UK is coming on board quite substantially in climate change development programming. And we are working together in a few countries already. The same thing is happening with Germany. When it comes to Sweden, we resonate very well in the way of thinking, but we don't see Sweden a lot in the field of funding climate change programs, and any particular not in forestry. I think I've been quite surprised by that, actually, to see knowing the proud history of Sweden in the forestry sector domestically and of Sweden in the forest sector in development programming. I think there's a lot of knowledge and there's a lot of experience. Sweden is a good brand name in many developing countries. You say that you have limited resources, and of course that's in terms of money. When politicians focus on human rights and health and things like that, you get less for natural resources. You also have limited resources in terms of people, which of course is troubling every bureaucracy. But it is a result of somebody's decision. Is it the result of a decision in your ministry who is allocating resources to CEDA? Norway has a forest sector, tiny like this compared to Sweden's. So if you look at where the expertise should be, it would be here. So that's why I'm surprised that Sweden didn't get onto the stage very, very visibly in RED and climate change funding, because it would have you would have a very natural and important role in that work. I think when programming these things, we need to look at the evidence, of course, as we have mentioned, and you have endorsed that from Sweden, from CEDA and DFID. We need to be careful not to be too strict, and that's one. Basically, the only complaint I have about the report is that the selection of literature that you have used as a result of your rigorous methodology gets us to an area, to a conclusion, set of conclusions, which would be too restrictive in order to make policy decisions on very acute climate change problems. So it's an important input, but it's not sufficient for the donor agencies to use as a basis for their policy decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ivar. Thanks. That's useful and interesting comment. I like that conclusion about what is necessary and sufficient for something to happen. That resonates well with what we always discuss in impact evaluation. But it's hard to see that any report as such would be both necessary and sufficient. Hopefully it will act together with other things. That was a little bit about the bilateral perspective. And before we sort of turn to the discussion and the debate with all of you, it would be interesting to hear a little bit about the multilateral perspective. So we've invited Anders Wallberg here today, so we invite you to come up here as well. And Anders is head of climate and environment at the Department for Multilateral Development Cooperation with the Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and he is also a member of the Green Climate Fund Board. Yes, you can either sit down or stand up. You will be called into action, I'm sure, later again. Anders, the word is yours. Thanks. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I also welcome very much this report. I think its conclusions are both relevant and timely. The issue of how to work in an integrated fashion, how to pursue multiple objectives, is something that is very close to heart to the Swedish government. And in its development cooperation, this is something that we have been pursuing very actively in the various multilateral climate funds and environment funds that we participate in. And I've had the privilege myself to be working with this during a few years, both as a member of the Global Environment Facility, the GEF, and the Green Climate Fund, the GCF. And I would say that the conclusions of the study are very much in line with our own thinking. I welcome the focus on ensuring that there is stronger evidence in terms of evaluation, not only for climate, but also on social economic impacts. This is something that we have been pushing for very strongly and that Sweden has pioneered, not least in the GEF. And we were very pleased that during the latest replenishment resolution, there was actually language to the effect that GEF will pursue much stronger, also in terms of evaluation, measuring not only climate and environment impacts, but also social and economic co-benefits. So this is fully in line also with the recommendations of the panel, and it's also that we need people who have a competence not only in climate but also in as it says, welfare impact, social and economic. And there was a recent evaluation made in the GEF by the evaluation unit on its biodiversity program that came to exactly the same conclusion. So I'm very pleased to hear that there is a lot of convergence here in the analysis, that there is need to make better use of both the potential to of synergies between environment, climate, and development, but also to be able to evaluate the impact. On the GCF, the Green Climate Fund, we're also pleased that already in the governing instrument of this fund, there is very clear, it's a very clear objective that the fund should maximize synergies between social, economic, and environmental benefits. So already at this sort of the founding document, there is a very strong focus on this. Now it remains, this remains to be implemented, and it's clear that it is a resource. I think I also agree with the authors of the study that it is probably resource intensive, but it's probably also worth investing in. We often hear from the Miles Ratler Fund that this is not easy, it requires resources, but I think it's definitely something that's worth looking into. Perhaps just one reflection on the one of the recommendations, actually the last one, which talks about need for strengthening domestic capacity in the recipient countries and domestic independent research institutes are given the mandate and necessary resources to fulfill this important role. I agree, this is important. It is something also Sweden is working together with others to strengthen domestic resources. On the other hand, I think this is something that we need to see as it's a process. It's obviously not the, not something that we're going to achieve overnight. In some countries, there research institutions are stronger than in others. And I think we also need to work with intermediary stopgap measures in that regard as well. But I think it's an important point. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Thank you, and we'll be able to get back with questions to you as well afterwards. Now, before, again, it's not that I'm postponing things, but but before turning to questions and debate, we'd like to hear what you, as the authors of the report, what kind of comments you might have when you have heard from the bilateral and multilateral actors, how they view the report, its strengths, limitations, and steps forward. So please come up here as well.
Thank you. My name is Gunnar Schulin, and I'm from University of Gothenburg, as was mentioned. But I'm also the director of something called the Environment for Development Initiative, funded by CEDA, which is, just picking up on the very last point by Anders here, is creating exactly that capacity to do these kinds of impact evaluations in developing countries. And I would just like to stress two aspects of the report that has also been discussed here. And the first one is the fundamental gap of both capacity and use of that capacity to do this kind of impact evaluation. So over and above, I think the report gives very good evidence of this, but it's much more fundamental than we even mention in this report. I've been involved in various bilateral programs since the 80s, mostly in Ethiopia. And what you see is, of course, a lot of good intentions when programs are started to, oh, of course we should have applied research, we should have impact evaluation, we should have a proper monitoring evaluation system. But in the end, very little comes out of that. And I think that there are fundamental challenges here and incentives from the donors, from the implementing agencies, and also, we should say, from academia. As an academic, you don't really have any strong incentives to get your hands really dirty in these programs. So given what's at stake here, I mean, climate change is an incredible challenge. World poverty is an incredible challenge. We have this instrument of development aid, and we're now spending billions of dollars. And I think that we need to take this issue seriously of how we actually make the most out of this money. And I think that we need to address this very fundamental incentives for not doing it right. And what I've found since we started this report and we did the systematic reviews, I found myself using this as an argument in many cases to substantiate this feeling that I've had since the end of the 80s. At the same time, I've spent this time trying to address it by building capacity, and Subrando, understandably, at the end of his presentation, kind of slipped over the Ethiopian experience. But I would like to pick up on that. It's supported by Norway, and it's doing exactly what Anders recommended. We've been starting to build capacity in Ethiopia since in early 90s. And now this capacity is pulled together and put in place with a clear mandate to take on this challenge that Ethiopia has put on itself to become a middle-income country by 2025 with even lower emissions than they had in 2010. Now, this is, of course, crazy. No other countries have done this. And all the donors, after Lima, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, France, UK, US, everybody's gathering behind this. Billions of dollars will be spent. We thought, why don't you use at least a fraction of this to support local capacity to do the real-time impact evaluations? And the government and the donors have agreed to this. So I just give this as a ray of sunshine here. You know, if we really want to do it, it can be done. And I really think we should. So thank you.
Thank you. That's a good optimistic note. I noticed that there are several optimistic notes about the availability of evidence, partnerships, new research initiatives, and everything else, which is fine, of course. Yes, it's fine. So Brenda?
Sure. Since there's so much optimism flowing around, maybe it behooves me to be a little bit pessimistic. I'm completely sympathetic with the idea that we have to be pluralistic in how we gather evidence. And so our mandate was not to, there were seven of us working, but we weren't working full time. We were working, you know, a little bit of time to sort out the literature. And in that time, I think our goal was to see, are there quantitative studies out there that have proven that when you do, not that forests are bad or good, but forest policies that have been implemented or forest projects or programs in some settings, in some places, have they made people richer? And I think there are different opinions on this, but there is very little hard evidence that people are actually richer when they live in flourishing forests in tropical countries. I think it's elusive to believe that you get happy, nice, growing forests. I've been studying this for 35 years now, and you get rich and happy people right there. There is a little bit of a trade-off, and it would be nice when you start with 1,200 studies, you know, only about 20 of them are actually tending to look at this problem, right? I mean, that's one piece of evidence we bring to it. You should bring the other case studies and anecdotes. They should combine. We should move forward. But it would be nice if there were 100 studies, and then we could conclusively be answering more of these questions. So I would still push for a few more systematic attempts to look at inequality reduction or poverty reduction that are specifically tied to specific policies on the ground, not the general idea that Brazil has a lot of forests. It doesn't have a lot of poor people. Therefore, it must mean that forests cause poverty reduction. You know, there's a lot going on there, and it's not just the spaghetti there, but the mapping from the funds to actions, from the actions to the outcomes, is always a bit challenging. And the last point, I do want to endorse a couple of things that Mark and then Anders just mentioned. We've been recruiting for a director of the International Development Group at Duke University, and these are all World Bank vice presidents who have served, you know, they've been career bankers. And they bring this point to note, and this community should also recognize that. ODA is a shrinking part of the global development landscape. Private equity and foreign direct investments are changing the world. And that is allowing big players like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates to arrive on the scene and dictate a lot of what is happening on the ground. And so, of course, we had no bandwidth. If you talk about government funds, which are in theory supposed to be transparent and accountable, you have no idea where private funds are going. And there is no database that you could mine to sort of look at that. But that doesn't mean that there aren't impacts of these activities. So in many places, you might not be seeing health outcomes because the Gates Foundation is running a big project, which has nothing to do with the government. And so I think we have to be very mindful and start thinking about what the role of FDI and private equity in the development space, because it is a much bigger, growing, and continuing to grow proportion. And as climate becomes mainstream, private sector will move in a much bigger way, And if we are unprepared, we will be playing a small role.
Thank you. Thank you. That's also some sobering thinking.